No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or you can Skype us at BBSRADIOONE. Maria's not with us tonight. She's home recuperating. She's a little under the weather. So my best goes out to her. And I hope she's feeling better and she'll be back with us next week. I would also like to take a moment to send my condolences to the family of Ashley Gundon. Ashley was sworn into the police department on Friday, and on Saturday she was killed when she responded on her first call to a domestic violence situation. Our hearts go out to her family and our condolences. Today we have a special guest, Joe Libertelli of the UDC Law School. But before I bring him on, I need to give two shout-outs. One to Ruben Hinojoso, representative of Texas 15th District, a Democrat, of course, 130 co-sponsors for the statehood bill now. Representative Hinojosa, thank you. You're 130th co-sponsor. That brings the total in both houses to 149, more than we've ever had in the 210 years that we've been at this. And also, a big shout out to my daughter Trisha, who turns 23 today. It's hard to believe. It seems like just yesterday she was calling me daddy and asking for her allowance. Actually, that was yesterday that she was calling me daddy and asking her for her allowance. But now she's all grown up and she's out on her own, and I hope she's working hard so that she can support her daddy in his old age to the lifestyle that he would like to become accustomed. So without further delay, all that business being out of the way, let me introduce our special guest, Joe Libertelli, who is head of the University of the District of Columbia Law School's Alumni Association. Are you with us, Joe? Thanks for being on.
I'm here, and I'm chuckling about your daughter because I have two daughters who are growing up fast, and I think I'm going to use the same line. Lifestyle to which I hope to become accustomed. I like that.
Well, you know what? I mean, it was great when she was in college and she would stand there and pound her fist on the table and tell me how men were screwing up the world for women. And then she would turn around and ask me for her rent money. And I would say to her, "No, honey, I'm done oppressing you. Go be free. Pay your own damn rent." But no, she's a great kid, and I'm lucky. How old are your daughters?
17 and 19. My 19-year-old is a sophomore at the University of Maryland.
And my
17-year-old
is
in the throes of college applications, even as we speak.
Well, that's where we are, too. We have an 18-year-old. We have one that's about to turn 21 who's a junior in college in Washington State. Trisha is an honors graduate at DePaul University. Our baby just got a scholarship, a partial scholarship to University of Illinois. So we're excited about that. She hasn't decided where she's going to go yet. But I will say to your daughter, I am a proud Maryland Terrapin. I was a little upset yesterday to see our men's basketball team, which is in the top 10, probably not in the top 10 anymore, as they got beat by Purdue in a very tough game yesterday. But Maryland's a great school, and UDC is a great school. And one thing that people don't know about UDC is that it's a very old school. A lot of people think it's a relatively new school.
Well, UDC, a couple of the constituent programs, colleges that formed the university, I think were around in the 1800s. There's Minor Teachers College and DC Teachers, Federal City. And then the Antioch School of Law, which I know most about, was started in 1972 and later merged into the university after it had become a public law school in the district.
Well, and, you know, I do work with the Thurgood Marshall Fund, and great organization that sponsors HBCUs. They give scholarships and give money to historically black colleges and universities, and UDC is one of them, and so was Miners Teachers College. And you're right, it goes back to the mid-1800s, so it's very old. I think it may even be older than the University of Maryland, which was an old land-grant college that goes back to the early to mid-1800s, which my children would tell you is when I attended. But
well, speaking of land-grant colleges, UDC is actually the District of Columbia's land-grant university and is the nation's only land-grant university and has a fantastic program. Dean Sabina O'Hara runs the College of Agriculture, Urban Sustainability, and Environmental Sciences at UDC. We have a 140-acre farm. That's a very well-kept secret. It's actually in Beltsville, Maryland. There's not a lot of available farmland in the district. But that College of Agriculture, Urban Sustainability, and Environmental Sciences, I'd like to nominate it for best acronym in the district. It's CAUSES. So I don't know. I haven't heard a better acronym than that. Maybe someone knows out there.
No, well, that and you know, Beltsville is where the Department of Agriculture also has its research center. So that's I used to work in Beltsville, not far from there. So that's a great place to have an agricultural facility. And I imagine that urban sustainable farming is all the rage these days.
It is, and UDC is really at the forefront of it under Dean Sabina O'Hara's leadership. UDC has established or is in the process of establishing urban food hubs in each of the district's wards, meaning not only is the university supporting gardeners and farmers, but also helping people process the food and start businesses based on it. So it's really quite a visionary program, and there's lots of exciting things happening.
Well, that's great. That's a great idea. Our listeners who have never been to the District of Columbia might not realize that we have a lot of community gardens in the in the District of Columbia. They're very popular. I have one in my neighborhood, and I think the one in my neighborhood primarily feeds the raccoons in the neighborhood. But but they're very popular. A lot of people have plots, and you know what? It's not just about making food, it's also about building community, because you know, it's open to everybody in the community and people gather there, and I think you're very positive. It's kind of a win-win thing.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about the law school a little bit. How many students in the law school?
Just over 300, so it's a very small law school. We're evenly divided between people in the part-time program and the day program. In the part-time program, which is run primarily in the evening, we've got lots of folks who have full-time jobs working in various walks of life, D.C. agencies, federal agencies, private sector, of course. And so people come from all over the country to go to the UDC David A. Clark School of Law, named for, of course, our former council chair, our late council chair, Dave Clark.
Who was a great guy. Really, you know, as a politician, he's a role model for all of us. He was really a guy from my experience with him. I really didn't know him. I met him a few times, but But from what I remember of his, his time on the city council, he was somebody that really cared about the people, really cared about our community, and he was a shining example to me, at least, of what a public servant should be. And you know what? I think that I agree mostly with William Shakespeare and what he has to say, but I disagree that there's nothing in a name. I think there is something in a name, and when it comes to the David A. Clark Law School, I'd like to say that most of the graduates that I've met do some sort of public service or government work. Haven't met a lot of personal injury lawyers coming out of UDC Law School. I've met a lot of them have worked in our office, and a lot of them give back to the community, and I think that's really, really a great thing.
Well, we are a public interest law school, but I do want to say a few words on behalf of personal injury lawyers. If you think about what personal injury lawyers do, they often represent people of lesser means who have been injured and whose livelihoods have been either interrupted or ruined. Lives can be ruined, and sometimes it's a big and powerful entity that's made through the negligence of a powerful entity, this person's gotten hurt. And so the personal injury bar helps level the playing field, and I know they're derogatorily referred to as ambulance chasers, but they actually do a lot of good for people. Maybe occasionally things go overboard and cases are brought that shouldn't be, but I think overall they play a valuable role in society. So I have to stand up for our friends in the private bar as well.
Well,
we are primarily a public interest law school.
I've been dutifully rebuked, and I apologize to personal injury lawyers everywhere. I'm sure they do some really great work, but you know, my point was that I have met so many graduates of your law school that do public interest work, and you know, this is a problem we have in the District of Columbia, is that outside the District of Columbia, people think we all work for the IRS, or we all work for, you know, the Defense Department, or we'd all work, have government jobs, but many of us work for public interest groups and groups like AARP and the National
Right.
Organization of Women and other groups that really try to make a better world for all of us. So I'm
Absolutely.
Proud to represent people like that, and I'm sure you are too.
I am. I chose this this work stick with. I've been in support of the law school since I started at the Antioch Law School in 1982. I worked on the campaign to turn it into a public entity, and then some years later took a paying job when I actually needed to make money. My wife and I had those two little girls who I referred to, and so I've been working at the law school since 1998 as alumni director. And it's terrific. I've gotten to know a lot of the students and stayed in touch with them as alumni, of course. And they're out making a difference throughout the district. The majority of our alums, of our students, come in from beyond the district, but then the majority stay in the metro area. So we really are building the economy and bringing a lot of terrific people into this region, the district, and its immediate environs.
Well, that's great. And, you know, I find that with a lot of people that they come here to go to college, or they come here for some other reason, for a government job, and they stay because it really is a great community that we have. And people really, really do give back. Let me ask you a question about being a part-time law school. My sister was a lawyer. Great lawyer, as a matter of fact, and she graduated from GW Law School. While she was in law school, we had a really, really hard time in life. Both my parents passed away when I was 15 years old, and my sister took control of my life, and she and I acted out in just ridiculously hideous ways. I'm surprised she didn't have me killed, but She took over my life. She worked full time and she tried to go to school part time, but GW and several other schools, law schools in Washington, didn't offer part-time programs. They made an exception for Patricia and let her go year-round, which was the best they could do. They lessened her workload a little bit and let her go over the summers. So she went 12 months a year to graduate. But she couldn't find a part-time program. Is that still the case? Are they very unusual?
No, I think there are several part-time programs in the district. One of the major advantages, in addition to the public interest orientation that UDC has, is that we are among the most diverse law schools in the country: African American students, Latino students, and we also have many students who are older than typical law students. Faculty also reflects that, and then the other big distinction is that we are much less expensive than the other area law schools, particularly if people are D.C. residents. And so that makes it possible for people in both the part-time program and the day program to graduate with much less debt than they might have otherwise had. And that makes taking those less than super high-paying public interest jobs more realistic for them. So UDC's part-time program does have some significant advantages over the others.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. And you know, when you talk about diversity, too, an amazing thing to me is that my sister, my older sister, who would have graduated from law school in like 1964, 1965, was just a handful of women at GW. There were just a handful of women. I mean, I can't even remember how many, but I think you could have counted all of them on your fingers. There were less than 10. Right. And now I think the majority of the law school, at one point I read, they were graduating more women than men. So, you know, it's just come, the legal profession has come so far for women in this city. And I think that's amazing.
It's true. That is true across the board. I think that the majority of law school graduates are women. At UDC, I know 65% of our students are women. And I think it's four of our five deans are women. The top dean, Shelley Broderick, who's been with the law school since, I believe, 1978, and our academic dean, Lori Morin, dean of students, Anna Maria Stewart, who, by the way, is the rising president of the D.C. Bar, and then our dean for admission is Tahira McCoy. We also have one man, William Nelson. He's the dean for administration.
Good.
So it's most of my bosses, my two daughters, my wife, and most of my bosses at work are women. So,
I just have to add a little personal note here that I can't imagine having a better boss than Shelley Broderick. Shelley Broderick is one of our favorite people. She's not only a really great lady, but a big supporter of DC statehood and
Absolutely.
The kind of things that we do. She would
reprimand me. She said we're colleagues. We're colleagues. She's not my boss. She's my colleague. Well, you know, there's a lot of truth to that, but she still is the dean. And Shelley was one of my professors in 1982. She was one of three professors of criminal procedure at the Antioch School of Law. She ran the criminal defense clinic at that time. And she was one of just a small handful of Antioch professors that kind of got the politics of the situation and supported the student efforts to save the school. And as a result, we managed to keep it going. And she worked her way up through virtually every position and certainly earned her way to the dean's position. And she's now one of the longest-serving deans in the country and is continuing to do an excellent job for the school. We hope, survived our most recent accreditation visit. They come every 7 years now that we're fully accredited, as we have been since about 10 years. And we'll find out formally what the results are, I guess, in a month or two. But the tea leaves appear to be good. We have our fingers crossed, of course, but we think it went pretty well.
Well, I know that's a tough process. My brother just retired as the president of the number one community college in America, a college in Zane State, in Zanesville, Ohio. And the really interesting thing about Paul is that he started at a community college. My mom, when she passed away, my mom worked at Montgomery College as a secretary, and they offered Paul and I tuition waivers to begin our college education. We both took advantage of that. So Paul knew the community college business from the bottom up. But prior to becoming the president of the college, he was the vice president of the largest community college in the world, Community College of the Air Force. And they had 250,000 students around the world. They have campuses on every Air Force base in the world. And most of what he did during his tenure was to get the college accredited. It took many years for him to get accreditation for the college. And I know that it was really, really a tough process to go through. And he did that. And then in his spare time, he was an F-111 pilot. And he gradually, he retired at the ripe old age of 42 and went into college administration, got his doctorate in education at Vanderbilt.
One could almost say you're the underachiever of the family.
Oh, my God, I'm such the underachiever. But
a senator.
I have great advice for all the young people that may be listening. When I was orphaned, I acted out in really terrible ways, one of which was dropping out of high school. So even though my sister was an honors graduate and my brother was an honors graduate and did all these things, when I finally saw the light and went back to school and got a GED and then went on to college and ended up with a master's degree, in my family, I was a real hero, even though I didn't achieve as much as anybody else. You know, they used to say things like, did you hear that Patricia was nominated for a Nobel Prize? And they would say, yeah, but, you know, Michael's in college. So my advice to young people is burn out early, lower expectations, and then no matter what you do, you'll look good. Because that's
I don't know if I like that strategy.
Work for me.
It could work. I could see how it could work. Yeah.
But you're right. My brother and sister were both. My sister was the first woman partner in one of the biggest law firms in Washington, D.C. And my brother, like I said, Air Force pilot, educator. So we're very proud of both of them. I hope my children aren't listening, because that's not advice that I ever gave them. And their mother, the valedictorian of her class, would probably beat me up if she heard me say that. So UDC is a community school in the sense that it gives back to the community. Tell me again, how old is the law school?
Well, depends on how you measure it. We've gone through several phases. The Antioch School of Law was founded by Jean and Edgar Kahn, an interracial couple, by the way, in 1972. And they did that after having a program at GW called the Urban Law Institute that was intentionally created as a clinical law program, which was very unusual at the time. And that means that students work on real cases for real clients under supervision and learn the law kind of in the way that medical school graduates do as interns working under supervision. And my reading of history, or my understanding of what happened, was that they sued too many powerful people in the district on behalf of poor people in the public interest, and GW made it clear that they needed to either tone down or find some other place to do their work. And so the Kahns decided to start their own law school, and they searched around the country. They knew that it would be a much easier road to get accreditation if they had a presentable university backing them. And they found Antioch College at the time, which was very liberal and interracial in its orientation, and also had a tradition of hands-on education. They had their co-op system where students worked a semester and then went back to class. And so Antioch College essentially invested in this concept, as did a number of very prominent attorneys around the country. The cons, I should say, were both Yale law graduates and had written a law review article entitled The War on Poverty, A Civilian Perspective, that catalyzed the creation of the Federal Legal Services Program and resulted in the representation of millions of poor people by the legal services offices that we now see all around the country and perhaps take for granted. But that program was actually created in a large measure by the cons' activism as law students, which was extremely unusual. But they then wanted to create a law school that trained attorneys to do the kind of work that the legal services corporation and offices required. And that required hands-on work under supervision so that students could become acquainted with the problems that poor people deal with on a day-to-day basis and how the legal system works and usually does not work very well on their behalf. So they created the Antioch School of Law in 1972. Its first class graduated in 75, and I believe it had its full accreditation. It was the first law school ever to get its full accreditation before the graduation of its first class. Antioch lasted, and this is a long story which I could get into in detail. I don't know how much you want, but it lasted until 1988, which was when the D.C. School of Law started. And that ran as a separate public law school, same program as Antioch, same library book, same faculty, until D.C. ran into its big financial crisis in the mid-90s. And then to save money, the council merged the law school, the D.C. School of Law, into the University of the District of Columbia. And that was, I believe, in 96 or 97. And we've been at UDC ever since.
Let me ask you a question. I'm a little confused. Is this the Antioch Law School that's connected with Antioch College in Ohio?
Yes, it affiliated with Antioch College in Ohio, which at that time became Antioch University. And right. Antioch University created, I think it was over 30 campuses of different types all around the country. It kind of the alternative education movement blossomed in the 70s. And then in the 80s, during the Reagan era, it kind of imploded, and Antioch University was slow to close its money-losing campuses, and one of the challenges that the cons face is that Antioch University was starting to charge a significant amount of overhead for administrative services to the law school, and it was essentially a battle for control of the law school that the cons eventually lost. And so Antioch University maintained the law school, but it couldn't invest enough resources to keep it going as a law school, and eventually had to let it go too. And it's had it's contracted. Antioch University has contracted further and further. It did in fact close its college not very long ago, and in a delicious ironic episode, we hosted several of Antioch College alumni meetings talking about how they could save the college. And in fact, the Antioch College alumni did rally and save Antioch College, and it's back up and running. It's a great place.
It has
Ohio.
A great reputation.
Yeah.
I know that you have some other things to do tonight, Joe, and we're very grateful that you've taken the time to be with us. But I can't allow you to leave until we talk a little bit about D.C. statehood. You've been a long-term resident of the District of Columbia. Why do you think you got any insight into why we can't get people more excited about D.C. statehood? You know, we have rallies and 150 people show up.
I have been pounding my head into this question for quite a long time, since I got to the district in 82. And I have actually argued with, in the late 80s, I was involved in a grassroots effort out in California in support of the Dukakis campaign, to try to mobilize peace and justice activists into the fold of the Democratic Party and support Dukakis. And so that was an interesting effort. But in the process, I did a lot of tabling, just grassroots tabling in Orange County, not exactly a bastion of liberalism. And And through that, I had the opportunity to talk with a lot of people out there and argue with a lot of people. And I think that the average conservative, if they actually out around the country, if they really understood that that D.C. residents, though they pay a higher percentage of income tax than most states, and they are required to serve and have served with distinction in the armed forces, have no representation in Congress. That outraged people. People actually argued with me. They said that was not possible. So I think that there's a big gap in understanding, but I don't think that that merely closing that information and education gap in the minds of the American citizens around the country would solve the problem. I think that there's obviously a power issue here. I don't think that the conservative forces in this country are going to want to see the D.C. voters get two members of the Senate. And so there's a real power issue. They're going to do everything they can to prevent us from getting that representation. And I think that we need to do something to punch through and make this issue really prominent in the minds of people all across the country. And I actually have a modest suggestion I'd like to float.
Oh, please.
I would be willing to do nonviolent civil disobedience in a time, place, and manner as determined by yourself, Dean Broderick, Wade Henderson, Kim Perry of DC Vote, and maybe a handful of other responsible leaders. If 4,999 other people made that commitment, I think I've done civil disobedience against the arms race. I've done it against apartheid in South Africa. I'm not willing to go out and get myself arrested if it's not going to make a splash, if it's going to be something that fades away. But if we were to create a situation where we could put out the challenge and get people to agree to do it, if a large number, 5,000 people made that commitment, I think that's a large enough number. If we forced the authorities to arrest that many people, I think that would underscore the importance and the outrage this absence of representation has. And I've talked with Shelley Broderick. She's willing to serve on this on such a committee. I've talked with Wade Henderson. He would be certainly willing to do that. And I think we could orchestrate the publicity to make quite a wave. And I think we could get people from every state in the union, and we could probably get people from other countries, too, to come in and join us in making this kind of statement. So...
Well, that's
maybe
a great
that's my
idea.
Parting comment.
No, and I want to sign up for it, and you know, okay. And I'd like to say to Wade Henderson, who's out there, he just retired as a major civil rights leader in America, so he's got a little spare time on his hands. Maybe we can.
He was willing to do it even before he retired. Yes,
but you know. We had 71 of us, maybe you remember this, led by the former mayor. 71 of us got arrested. I actually got arrested and went to trial and was the only one convicted. There were 9 of us that went to trial, and we were all convicted, but the other 8 appealed and got off. I, on the other hand, was convicted and had to pay a $100 fine. I remember the judge, the district judge, I want to say his name was Satterfield. I can't remember
exactly. Lee Satterfield
exactly.
Would be a D.C. Superior Court judge.
Well, the judge that we had said that he admired us so much, that we were his heroes, because he admired people that stood up for their principles, and then he found us guilty. And he said, but even standing up for your principles, you can't sit in the middle of the street and block traffic. So he found us guilty of incommoding something that I didn't understand. But
well, thank you for doing that, and I would be happy to be guilty of a similar offense myself. I think that the number was unfortunately just too small. We need to try to orchestrate things so that it's a number that everybody will have to notice all around the country and around the world.
Well, that's true, and 5,000 would do it because 71 people so overwhelmed the Capitol Police that it took, you know, like 12 hours to process everybody. The people were there for a very long time, even though most of them paid, you know, paid the fine. All but 10 people paid the fine and walked. But it's still only 71 people kind of gummed up the works. 5,000 would be amazing, and I think that's a good goal, and I think that we should try and do that, and I'd like to volunteer for it, and if you can get Shelley and Wade on board, I say go for it.
They said they would be part of the committee that helped design the action, the protest, and also orchestrate the publicity, because obviously, you know, we don't want to just get arrested. We want to milk it. We want to publicize it. We want to educate using the run-up to it, not only to gather the 5,000, but to educate on the issue and the absolute outrageousness of it. And think about it. There are so many people who would feel much more confident if they knew that there were really that many people that were going to do it with them. They would know that there's no chance the police are going to beat them up. The police in D.C. actually are quite good when it comes to civil disobedience, yes. I must say. So I think it's a safe way to organize.
It's a great idea. And I think we should have a target date of April 16th, 2017, which is Emancipation Day in the District of Columbia, the day we freed the slaves. It's the only official holiday of the District of Columbia, and I think that would be a great idea. Well, we're going to let you go.
Joe, all right, thank you very much.
Thank you. No, thank you so much for being on, and I hope we can have you back again. Well, maybe we can get you and Shelley and Wade Henderson to come on and talk about this idea.
This idea they agreed to several years ago. I hope that they're still as enthusiastic as they were. I think they will be, and I would be happy to help you invite them. And I would be very pleased to be back on with them and you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you come back again soon. We're going to take a little break here so that I can get a drink of water, and then I'll be back to continue on solo. So we'll see you in just a few minutes. Thanks.
Mr. Worldwide to infinity, you know the roof on fire. We go boogie, oogie, oogie, jiggle, wiggle, and dance like the roof on fire. We go drink drinks and take shots until we fall out like the roof on fire. Now, baby, get my booty naked, take off all your clothes and light the roof on fire. Tell him, baby, 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 I'm on fire. I tell her, baby, 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 baby.
And we're back. And that was Pitbull with the song Fireball. And that's dedicated to Donald Trump, who is on fire, America. I don't know why, but he's out there and he's doing well. And I find it so perplexing. If anybody within the sound of my voice has some explanation about why he's doing so well, I wish you would call and tell me. But as most of you know, Tuesday is commonly referred to these days as Super Tuesday, because it's primaries, mostly in the South, that is the biggest primary day in the United States. The Republicans have 11 primaries up. The Democrats have 12. The Republicans have Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Massachusetts, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Vermont, Virginia, Alaska, and Minnesota. Alaska and Minnesota are caucuses. The rest are regular primaries. The Democrats have Alabama, Alaska, Georgia, Massachusetts, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Vermont, Virginia, Colorado, Minnesota, those are all. Oh, and American Samoa, which is a territorial caucus. Colorado, Minnesota, and American Samoa are caucuses. And as you may or may not know, I was just recently at the Iowa caucuses. We did a show from Iowa the night before the caucuses. And the caucus system is very interesting. It's a lot different than just going in and placing a vote. But there's a lot at stake on Tuesday. And when it comes to Mr. Trump, it looks like in many states, many of these states, he's on top. In Georgia, for example, he's now polling at 30%, with Cruz and Rubio tied at 23%. In Tennessee, somewhat of a moderate state. Let's not forget that Tennessee is the state that gave us Al Gore. Al Gore Sr. and Al Gore Jr., both liberals. There, Trump is polling at 40%, with Cruz and Rubio very close at 22 and 19. And, of course, in Texas, another big state, Cruz is ahead, but Cruz is from Texas. And Trump finds himself in the second spot and Rubio again in third. Now, if he should win big on Super Tuesday, let's say he wins the big ones. He wins Georgia, Tennessee, Alabama, he's not going to win Texas, but Virginia, Massachusetts, Oklahoma. This is going to be a devastating blow to the Republican Party. And, you know, the Republican Party, the establishment is trying desperately at this point to line up against him, but they're not doing a very good job. Guys, you got to, you know, get on the stick out there, because their opposition to this point has been very, very wishy-washy. And let's talk about this guy. I mean, he quoted Mussolini, for God's sakes. He's out there quoting Mussolini, and he's just been endorsed by David Duke. And if you don't remember who David Duke is, David Duke is a candidate. He's run for many offices, including president, I believe. But he's also a member of the Ku Klux Klan, and he was a grand wizard in the Ku Klux Klan. So this is the kind of support that this man is getting. And come on, America. We really can't allow this to happen, can we? This guy is just off the charts. And I got to tell you, I was in Iowa, as I said, and I went to the victory party for Trump. Of course, it was not a victory party because he lost in Iowa, but he lost to Rubio. But I had never seen so many angry people in my entire life in one place at one time. Not a single minority did I see. But these people were very, very angry, very hostile. And I think as a liberal, I have a responsibility, and the Democratic Party has a responsibility, and the Republican Party has a responsibility to try to figure out why these people are so angry. I don't think that Donald Trump wants to make America great again. I think he wants to get even with America. And I think his supporters want to get even with America. I think that they feel that they've been talked down to, that they've been assaulted by liberals, that political correctness makes them feel stupid and not part of the system. And we need to address that. And I don't think we're addressing that. I think we're still talking down to them. I think we're saying things like, you don't really want a gun. You're just too dumb to realize it. Let us explain to you why you don't want a gun. Instead of saying what we should be saying as liberals, we understand that you have a Second Amendment right to have a gun to protect yourself. But you know what? That doesn't mean that you have to make us vulnerable. We have a right to protect ourselves as well. And what we want to do is we want to work out reasonable gun laws that allow you to keep your gun and allow us to be safe. And you know what? I think the majority of Americans, we've done polls that show that the majority of gun owners are for things like background checks, and they are for things like they're not probably for registration, but they are for background checks. They are for certain limits on certain types of guns. And the reason that the far right is against all this is I don't think they trust liberals. I think they've been talked down to for so long that they no longer trust us. And, of course, the fact that our country has become so divided doesn't help the situation. I think we find that liberals are very often in the same position, that they don't trust conservatives. But you know what? We have to come together, America. And we've got Donald Trump out there, and instead of asking who he is, which is what we seem to be spending our time doing, is he a racist? Is he a ne'er-do-well? Is he someone that's capitalizing on hatred and bigotry? We should be asking why he is. Why is he doing so well? What is wrong with our national consciousness that a man who has no political experience, who is phenomenally wealthy, can't possibly understand what it's like to be a working class person, is coming off as this outsider that's going to save America? I have a question for Donald Trump. When did America stop being great? America is a great country. It's the greatest country on the planet as far as I'm concerned. And I don't think that he wants to make America great again. I think he wants to get even for all the people that have felt that they've been shut outside the system. So I think what we need to do is we need to come together and we need to say, not how is he going to do it? Is he going to do it? What can we do to stop him from doing it, as much as we need to say, why are people supporting this man and how can we address the issues that have made him popular? Because I think we really need to do that. If he wins on Super Tuesday, wins the big states, I think that the Republican Party is in a lot of trouble. I got to tell you, as a lifelong Democrat, I think that they've got trouble containing this man and making a viable presidential candidate out of him. He may be viable in the Republican Party, but I don't think he'll be viable to the country. And they're liable to lose more than just the presidency. I worked for Jimmy Carter in 1980, and a lot of people like to talk about the Reagan landslide. Well, it really wasn't a landslide. Reagan didn't win by a lot of votes, but it was a landslide in the sense that he won in almost every state. He only lost Minnesota, which the vice president was from, Georgia, which is the state that he was from, and the District of Columbia, because D.C. has never voted for a Republican for president, even though we've only been able to vote for president since the 1960s. So I think the problem with Carter was a lot of Democrats didn't show up. They were disappointed in his performance, and as a consequence, we lost the Senate, and we lost the House, and we lost people that were considered institutions like George McGovern. Well, this is going to happen to the Republicans if they're not careful. One, if they nominate Trump, that could happen. They could lose several seats in the Senate, which are up in solidly Democratic states. They could lose all sorts of other down ballot races, and they are already in trouble if he doesn't get the nomination. The 30 to 35% of the people in the Republican Party that have supported him may not show up on Election Day. And the same thing will happen to them that happened to us with Jimmy Carter. Carter was a fine man. I just like to point that out. Not Donald Trump. I don't think Donald Trump is a fine man. I don't think he has the best interests of America at heart. Jimmy Carter certainly had those things at heart. But the Republicans really, really got to do something about this guy, and they got to do it quick. Now, on the Democratic side, I think it's going to be much more of a horse race between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. But my prediction is that Secretary Clinton will come out on top on Super Tuesday, and that will certainly bolster her campaign. But I think it's a lot closer on the Democratic side than it is on the Republican side. So we'll just have to wait and see. And next week, as part of our show, we'll have a recap of what went on Super Tuesday. Maria Sanchez, my lovely co-host, who also happens to be a Republican, will be back next week. So maybe we can have a meaningful discussion from both sides. So I wish everybody out there a great week. Thanks for tuning in, as always. And enjoy the Academy Awards tonight. I got to be honest, I don't think I've seen one of the movies that's been nominated for Best Picture, but I'm going to watch anyway because it's always a fun night. I've got my bowl of popcorn ready, and we're ready to go. And thanks again to Joe Libertelli, and everybody out here there, have a safe and wonderful week, and we'll see you next week. Thank you.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.